Well, whilst Australia continues to try and comprehend the loss of Shane Warne at just 52, in Europe, the focus remains solely on the war in Ukraine. Now, some reports now suggest the Russians have lost something like 7,000 troops, experiencing a slower takeover of Ukraine than really even the most sceptical military minds envisaged just 10 days ago at the start of the whole thing. But whilst the Russian military machine does continue its slow encirclement of Kiev, and innocent civilians find themselves caught up in the whole thing, I think there are some important lessons we here in Australia should be learning, and pretty fast, from what's unfolding. Now, on one level, despite the obvious courage of the Ukrainian people, it's pretty hard to ignore the fact they find themselves outmanned and outgunned against their eastern neighbour. And many have warned that in a potential conflict in the Indo-Pacific, we in Australia would likely find ourselves in a very similar situation. On another level, despite the tough rhetoric and the sanctions, our Western European allies have found themselves caught between a rock and a hard place here. Because, put simply, without access to Russian gas and Russian oil, their cities' lights would probably go out. Put another way, the EU has basically become energy dependent on their greatest strategic threat. And in the process, they've made the same menace rich, and they've funded Russia's military modernisation. Now, again, parallels exist here, especially in the way our economy and our business community for years and years rushed to basically put all their eggs in the China basket, to the point where simply seeking, for example, clarification on the origins of a virus that killed millions around the world saw a number of our export industries face financial ruin with Chinese sanctions. Now, speaking of COVID, some of these questions, some of these issues were exposed by the effects of that pandemic. But I think what's happening in Ukraine should at least serve as yet another reminder that we need to get our act together when it comes to self-sufficiency and appreciating the crucial importance of strategic industries. In other words, surely the big events of the last 2 years should teach us that globalisation can't solve all our problems, that free markets and just-in-time delivery from somewhere else won't keep us comfortable and secure forever. I think somebody who understands this better than anybody is John Blackburn. He's the chairman of the Institute for Integrated Economic Research Australia, no stranger to my weekday program, and he joins us on the program. John, good morning to you once again.
Good morning, Michael, and thank you for the invitation.
My pleasure. Normally, I'd wish you a happy new year at this point, because we haven't spoken since January the 1st, but it's been anything but, and we look, obviously, internationally at what's happening in Ukraine, and I think it's true, there are some pretty important lessons we've got to learn quick, right?
Oh, I fully agree with you. Look, we've sort of had this belief in the last decade about this rules-based world order, and when you actually look at it, the Western countries may have been playing that way, but Russia certainly isn't, and you could say that their partnership with China that's being discussed at the moment means you've got two very large players who aren't playing on the same rules that everybody else thinks there is. And so the question to ask about Ukraine is, how were we thinking about that relationship with Russia and Europe? What assumptions did the Europeans make? Because as you've pointed out, in the last decade, they've grown their energy dependence on Russia on the assumption, I think, that some sort of mutual interdependence or would actually survive any issues or disagreements. And that's clearly not the case. So they've reduced their independence. They've had their sovereignty impacted because of their dependence on Russia for energy. But of course, people were assuming that, you know, Putin wouldn't be a madman and do what he's done. Well, there's another big assumption. So if you look at that, how does that apply to us? And the point you've raised there is pretty important. So again, over the last decade, and you and I have spoken about the energy and fuel things before, we have become more and more energy import dependent, you know, going from about 60% in import dependence probably about two decades ago to over 90%. And the way we're headed, I'm convinced that by the end of this decade, we'll be 100% fuel import dependent. Now, a country that allows its energy to become under the control of foreign companies and governments is not paying attention. I mean, the Americans are very strong on this. They've argued for a long time. You cannot allow your energy sources to remain under control of a foreign government. And that's why they've taken a lot of activities in the last decade to address it. But we've ignored it. And so we've got ourselves in a situation that is a real concern. Now, you raised the point of China. When I looked at the data for last year's import figures, of the refined fuel we bring in, so we bring in some oil for our remaining two refineries that won't be there that much longer, but all the refined fuel we bring in, 25% of all our jet fuel that comes in refined and 15% of all our diesel was coming from China.
Gosh.
And you've got to go, hang on. If we're so worried about China and we're going to get these nuclear submarines to deter them, and we've got all this rhetoric coming from the Prime Minister and the Defence Minister about China, why are we going along and increasing our import dependence on something so critical? Energy. It's crazy.
It doesn't make sense. And, I mean, on that very point, the Europeans, I mean, they've been flapping their gums pretty hard. And, look, some of the sanctions are biting, and that's credible. But the Europeans, according to news reports in the UK just yesterday, have, in fact, increased their importation of Russian gas and Russian oil since the start of the conflict. So you can't, on the one hand, can you, say, well, we're going to target some oligarchs and we're going to do this and we're all tough and mean and we're going to shut Putin down, and then at the same time increase the economic rivers of gold that come via oil and gas importation, which have allowed him to make his military rather modern and very potent.
Yeah, see, as we've talked about before too, the really important thing is don't just react to a problem, prepare for it.
Yep.
And yeah, that's what I've said in the past. Military's got this real thing about preparedness, training, getting ready. But by and large, what we tend to do as a nation is wait and react. And that's a serious problem for us. And so what's happening, I think, in Europe right now is they're reacting. They don't have any choice unless they've caused major damage to their economy and some of their societies to just turn off the tap from Russia. They actually have to live with it because they didn't prepare. We've got enough warning indicators here that we should be doing something about preparing for it. However, I'll just give you a quote here that was, I think, from Thursday morning's ABC News breakfast. And the Deputy Prime Minister was up there talking about these floods. And he said, you know, have you planned for something that hasn't happened before? That's the issue. And I think that reflects some of the thinking in some of our politicians. Well, yes, you can plan for something that hasn't happened before because that's what business does. That's what the military does. And we must plan for that, a range of issues that will happen in our region. And we can't just wait for it to go wrong like they've done in Europe.
No. I mean, you mentioned the rules-based order. I mean, that's a sort of a term that's thrown around a lot. But the rules-based world order, well, to that end, you can only keep order if you have the military hardware to back it up, if the rules are tested, right? And I mean, for all his faults, I mean, this is something that Donald Trump, I think, was trying to get into the skulls of the European leaders 3 or 2 years ago, saying you can't rely on the taxpayers of West Virginia and Vermont and wherever else to fund the American military because you in Europe don't want to fund yours. I mean, you know, people have to pull their weight.
Yeah, and I think there's a realization that the hope that we were in an era of continuing peace, apart from all the problems we've been having in Afghanistan and other countries, was here, was a false hope. The world's a nasty place. You've got basically a dictator in Russia who's going to do whatever he needs to do. He's made it quite clear he's going to do whatever he needs to do in Ukraine. I doubt if you go anything over the border because of the agreement with NATO and the US of acting. But he's also made quite clear threats or intimidation to Baltic states. I think it's Finland and Sweden. He's come out and said if they consider joining NATO, they will face serious consequences. So he's pushing, I guess, back to the previous Soviet Union thinking and heading out. This is a very serious and dangerous time. And clearly, he's doing something in close cooperation with the Chinese from all the media reports. And so we've got to say it's going to be a serious challenge for us in the next few decades that we can't just ignore. But also, I'd say there is no point in us standing here, you know, yelling or sticking and poking the Chinese government in the eye and saying, you should do this, you should do that. We need to have a serious think about, hang on, what's the scale of the problem? What are our options to do about it? And I've got to tell you, promising to deliver nuclear submarines in 15 years is not the solution. We've got a much nearer term problem.
Well, they won't be here in 15 years anyway. We might have the blueprints, but
no, they won't.
You know, I mean, we've spoken about this before a number of times.
Yeah.
But I mean, are we whistling in the wind here, John? Because you know, does the average? Well, I think a lot of the average Australians get it because they call me and they tell me they're worried about all of this sort of stuff. But they say the people in power. I mean, are there enough people there in Canberra focused on this kind of future-oriented strategic thinking, or is it simply, you know, the election cycles are only 3 years, they're too short for long-term planning, it ends up all this sort of petty squabble about who went to Hawaii on a holiday or who said something behind someone's back, you know, and the big stuff gets overlooked or brushed aside as too hard. What's the truth?
I think there is quite a number of individual politicians who are really concerned about this. They're smart people, they're trying to do the right thing. But I've also noticed since the start of the pandemic, with some of the Senate inquiries, the Joint Parliamentary Committee inquiries, the discussion about resilience and sovereignty and all this sort of stuff, there's been a lot of discussion about it. But it's like we're addressing the problem in a committee process. So we'll have, you know, it's great to have a committee finding or something, or we'll have a royal commission. And then it's like we've got a very slow bureaucratic process to address it. What's needed now is not business as usual, government reviews and whatever. We've got to mobilize ourselves. So if you remember, if those of people read, you know, history, say, from World War II, there was significant mobilization, particularly on the industrial side. I think Essington Lewis was the guy that led it. It's a really interesting history, where they mobilized in order to improve our industrial base with the threat of what was happening with World War II.
Mm.
Where we are today, where we've got this security challenge, we've got an energy transition challenge, we've got huge import and supply chain problems, there is still a risk of not just this pandemic, but another time coming. We've got the increasing problems that we're seeing with climate change and these poor people that we've seen on the East Coast with all these floods. This is not a once in a thousand year event. That's just an excuse. So what we've got is a whole series of complex problems. You can't solve those at the pace governments usually work. So we have to start talking about how do we mobilize our nation, because we've got the smarts, we've got the capabilities and the resources, we've just got to get that leadership to mobilize us to address this as a matter of urgency. Now, I said the language has been changing in Canberra. There's a lot of discussion across Australia about these issues in the media and in community groups. So I think the awareness is there. But the fixation of the major parties, unfortunately, is just on the next election, not the next decade.
Indeed. I love that thing you said earlier, don't just react to a problem, prepare for it. And I think really that, if that was one of the political party slogans, I think they'd walk it in, irrespective of all the other issues that float around. But alas, I'm not sure it's going to be their slogan. Wonderful to talk to you again, John. It certainly won't be the last time. Thank you, and we'll touch base again soon.
Great to talk to you, Michael. Thank you for that.
My pleasure. John Blackburn there, Chairman, as I said, of the Institute for Integrated Economic Research Australia.